So tonight I'm continuing this process of deconstructing the Satipatthana Sutta. We'll look at the other three sets of instructions that the Buddha has on mindfulness of body. When I first looked at the whole sutta, I was surprised so much was about body, but the Buddha actually was trying to sort of, when you look deeper, see, sort of taking you through this progression of ways of looking at the body, in a sense. So the first three, when we're mindfulness of breath and body position and ways of moving, were very sort of focused on things one little bit at a time. Notice this, notice this, notice this, notice this. And the next three, the other three, I suppose, focus more on taking a look at the body as a whole, or ways of looking at the body as a whole. In it, so it's a larger scale what it's doing, and so I want to start by reading from the sutta. This is the next set of instructions. Again, a bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down to the top of the hair. Bounded by skin, it's full of many kinds of impurities thus. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, dysentery, which, by the way, is how the internal organs connect to the spine. I had to look that one up. Contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Quite a list, huh? Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends, full of all sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millets, and white rice. And a man with good eyes would open it and review it thus. This is hill rice. This is red rice. These are beans. These are peas. This is millet. This is white rice. So too, a bhikkhu reviews this same body. So this is proper, this what he's talking about here popularly is sometimes called body scan, and it's where the certain sectors of the mindfulness world have put a lot of emphasis, not in the part of the mindfulness world I come from, however. This was some the thing that Goenka took so strongly, and if you're talking to a Goenka mindfulness person, this is what they practice. They practice body scan, where you literally start and go through parts of the body, and when you get to the end of the list, you start all over again. In my investigations, I also discovered there are many different versions of this list, different suttas. Besides the Satipatthana Sutta, have other versions of it and add things. That one of them has earwax in it, for instance, which I found fascinating because I just got my ears cleaned today. So, but it's like, what's going on here? I suppose would be the question you might want to ask, and I want to share some things that different people have said about this. The first thing is that the idea here is that we're sequencing. Notice what's going on here. We start with the outer, right? The hair and the nails and the skin. And then we start going in and looking at the flesh and then at the bones and then at the. So it starts from the outer to the inner. from the things that are more obvious, things that we see very clearly all the time in both our body and other bodies. And then we sort of start going deeper in, things that we might not be able to sense so clearly. I mean, can you sense how your internal organs are attached to the back of your body near your spine? Well, if you look closely enough and pay enough attention, you probably could. It's an interesting idea that it's going from the outer to the inner. And I want to share something that Analeo has to say here. And that's following in the Satipatthana Sutta to contemplate the unattractive nature of the body. Notice the word unattractive. Part of what is going on here is as you start to look at all the stuff that the snot and the urine and the feces and the joint oil and all these sort of gushy things that are in there, you sort of go, ew. And that was the intent. The intent at one level is simply to make people see that their body, other than on the very external level, wasn't particularly attractive. So that we got less conceited about our bodies. And then also that those other bodies that you sometimes look at and go, ooh, underneath the layers of skin and hair are all kinds of things that are just as unpleasant in that body as in this body. And so part of the intent here is simply to make people see that. I'm going to go on with Anileo here. Realizing the absence of beauty in one's own body thereby serves in particular as a countermeasure to conceit. Subsequently, as indicated, the same contemplation can be applied externally to the bodies of others. Such an external application can become a powerful antidote to sensual desire. The potential of this contemplation as a countermeasure to sensuality has led to its inclusion in Buddhist ordination ceremonies, part of which consists of instructing a novice monk or nun to contemplate the first five anatomical parts listed in this instruction. Despite these benefits, the exercise has possible dangers. Excessive contemplation of impurity can lead to loathing and repugnance. Loathing one's own body or that of others, however, is only an expression of frustrated desire and does not correspond to the calming of desire intended by the exercise. So this is, Analeo is like very clearly warning, waving, as I say, waving the yellow warning flag. If you're not careful, you can turn this into bodies are horrible. Poor me, I have a body. I was part of a yoga organization that this was part of the orientation, particularly among the sannyasins, the monks and nuns, that you sort of had to sort of think of bodies in this ooky way, as a way of sort of turning you off the idea of having any sensual desires or acting out on those sensual desires. But it's not skillful at all. It turns into, in its extreme cases, really sort of unhealthy views of bodies and how what bodies are for, etc. Analeo goes on. The need for a balanced attitude is exemplified by the simile in this part of the Satipatthana Sutta, which compares the contemplation of the anatomical parts to examining a bag full of grains and beans. This is the Buddha being practical. Like everybody who lived in that culture at that time would know exactly what all these grains and beans were and what they looked like. Just as examining these grains and beans will quite probably not stimulate any effective reaction, so contemplating the anatomical constitution of the body should be carried out with a balanced and detached attitude, so that the effect is of cool desire, not to stimulate aversion. So he's pointing to what we have to be careful about when we start to look at some of the Buddhist teachings, that we don't just go to that dangerous place of, ooh, it's a body. Aren't they all horrible? And the reason I'm emphasizing this is I've seen this attitude in various spiritual organizations. And so I'm concerned about that, and that's why I'm making a point of bringing it up here, that that's something we have to be very conscious of when we look at it. It's just, I mean, the Buddha's trying to say, make you say, you see, gee, these bodies are great, you know, they have all these parts, isn't that interesting? But notice how a lot of it isn't very pleasant looking. It's just the outer surface. Once you look underneath the surface, it isn't pleasant at all. I in my yoga teacher days, spent some times in anatomy labs, and certainly got that impression. I remember very distinctly, in one lab we were dealing with a cadaver, and we're sort of peeling back the top layer of skin, and then there's like this layer of muscle, right? And you look at the muscle and you think, well, if I cut that the right way and packaged it in cellophane, you could put it on the grocery shelf and no one would know the difference. That's what it was like. It was like just flesh. Didn't have any attractiveness at all. I mean, being a vegetarian might have taken away some of the attractiveness for me, but it's just like, that's what it looked like. It wasn't anything special at all anymore. It was just a slab of meat. It's just interesting to see it in that way. Okay, so that's the first of these, and this is just like this general idea of looking at the body in this broad sense, step by step. And it's also, of course, takes concentration. This is also a concentration exercise. We can't forget that. But this is a meditative practice where we're consciously scanning through our body, bit by bit by bit by bit, and then remembering what the sequence is, which takes concentration, and then when we get to the end of the sequence, starting all over again. This takes a lot of concentration. And it's just a different, it's concentrating on something that at the same time is reminding us about the nature of a body as a whole, as opposed to just the surface of a body. So that's one of these three sets of instructions. Then comes this. Again, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed, by way of the elements. Thus, in this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Just as though a skilled butcher or his apprentice has killed a cow and was seated at the crossroads with it cut up in pieces, so too a bhikkhu reviews this same body by way of the elements. In this body there is the air element, the earth element, the water element, and the fire element. And the air element. So when I first encountered this, it was like, huh? It was like, because this is so foreign, in a sense, to our way of seeing things. But in the India of that day and the India of today, too, for that matter, this was a way of seeing things. This was how Ayurveda views the body, how it sees the body in this way. And I want to read something else, something a little bit more from Analeo here. The ancient Indian scheme of four elements mentioned here represents four basic qualities of matter: solidity, liquidity or cohesion, temperature, and motion. Since contemplation of the 31 anatomical parts has covered mainly the first two of these qualities, solidity and liquidity, if you think of that list, it's all about bones and, you know, mushy things. The four-element analysis entails a more comprehensive approach, extending awareness to aspects of the body that manifest the qualities of temperature and motion. Thus, the present exercise further develops the analysis of the body on a more comprehensive and refined level. So, what Analeo is pointing to here is, here we go, here's another progression. And we look at these teachings and we go, oh, this is there's these six teachings on the body. But actually, they're very progressive. Start with breath, start with body position, then how the body moves in space, then look at the body as a, you know, in this way, internally, all the different things going on. And then let's step outside that view completely and instead look at the body through the lens of this traditional Ayurvedic way of looking at functions of the body. And Joseph Goldstein has a wonderful detailed look at this. And when I read this, I started to understand what's going on here. And he explains basically what these four elements and how we could focus on them might, what this might mean. The earth element refers to the common experience of solidity, the qualities of stiffness, hardness, or softness. So, if we're thinking of the earth element and trying to note, just remember this is all things that we can see and note. We could note when we're feeling particularly solid or grounded or steady, that what we're experiencing from this particular angle, this perspective, is the earth element. Next, the water element refers to the qualities of cohesion and fluidity. Imagine dry flour. On their own, its particles do not hold together. When we add water, the particles all adhere to one another, creating dough. According to the commentaries, the water element is not perceived separately from the other elements, but what holds them all together. Think of how your body is held together by the tissues, that if you dried them out, they wouldn't hold anything. But if you have the liquid in them, makes them be cohesive and hold everything else attached together. The fire element refers to temperature, heat and cold. It is also the feeling of lightness in the body. The fire element functions in different ways. It is how something is warm. It is that by which things age. Interesting. It is excessive heat that burns things up, and there is digestive heat. In Burma, this is called stomach fire. When it is strong, food gets well digested. When it is weak, there is stomach trouble. This is Ayurveda analysis, right? This understanding helps explain the Burmese fondness for very hot chili peppers. Although eating them creates a burning sensation, people enjoy it for its health benefits. Something I've heard this before. It's like all that spicy food helps you digest. Also helps you, makes you sweat, which in a hot climate like Burma makes sense. The air element causes movement in the body, the feeling of extension, expanding, and distending. It's also the feeling of pressure. In meditation, when you're being mindful of the rise and fall of the abdomen, we're really being mindful of the air element. So this is like this total other way that in our culture, we never look at the body this way. I mean, I never did until I sort of vaguely understood this until I started studying it more and looking at it. And I've heard teachers really strongly emphasize how this particular way of looking at the body has helped them deepen their understanding of the practice. To be honest with you, I've tried this, and it was for me, it was just like, oh, was that water? Or, now I spent too much time thinking and trying to figure out which of the four elements it was all the time, because it wasn't something that was familiar to me. I suppose if I put, if you put a lot more effort into it and started to look at it more precisely, that might change over time. I'm not saying you shouldn't do this or should do this. It's just this is the basis from where this came, right? But here's an interesting aspect of this, and this is both Anilayo talks about this, and Joseph talks about this as well. This is a way to start breaking down the sense of a separate self. Bear with me here. To experience oneself as a combination of material qualities reveals the qualitative identity of one's own body with the external environment. In this way, a healthy degree of detachment develops, counteracting the grasping at what is, in the end, merely a combination of material qualities. So everything we're experiencing is simply these four elements interacting with each other, the interplay of the elements. There's no thing there, no permanent separate thing. It's just these four elements in interplay. With sustained contemplation, a meditator may come to realize that this apparently so solid and compact material body, with it the whole material world, is entirely without essence. They are simply different degrees of hardness or softness, of wetness or dryness, of hotness or coldness, and some degree of motion, at least on the subatomic level. Contemplation of the four elements has thus the potential to lead to a penetrative realization of the insubstantial and selfless nature of material reality. Which is, that's a pretty huge mouthful. But what he's saying is, seeing the body in this way, because usually when we see the body, like in the previous exercise, where we were looking at the individual parts, it was like, oh, there's this part, and there's that part, and there's this part. They were all like separate parts, right? That somehow fit together. And now he's saying, well, but here's another way that this is what the Buddha is pointing to. He's pointing to, here's a way where you can see that there's no separateness in the pieces. The pieces are all just various combinations of these elements interacting with each other to create the idea of body. But body is just an idea in that sense. It's not, an absolute important thing. And then there's another thing I came across that I found really interesting. This is another thing from Joseph. And he's talking about understanding relative versus absolute reality. This is a central part of the Buddhist teachings that doesn't get talked about a lot. And I found it interesting that Joseph pointed to it very precisely here as, and so but let me explain. Basically, relative reality is what we experience moment to moment, day to day, in our just like life. It's relative. So there's, I get up and then I have my breakfast and then I go to work and blah, blah, blah. I get in my car. It's my car, my this, my that. That's relative reality. An absolute reality says, yes, but there's no one there. There's no, the idea that all those things you perceive and see in the world, the relative reality, are not really separate. That it's all connected together in one complete thing. And there's some interesting things to say about this. I want to share. As a way of understanding how these two truths relate to one another, think for a moment of being in a movie theater, completely engrossed in the story. You might feel happy, sad, excited, or terrified, all depending on the movie being shown. Now imagine looking up and seeing the movie being projected on the screen. We realize that nothing is really happening on the screen, except for the play of light and color. There's no one there actually falling in love or dying. Yet when we are absorbed in the story, it feels very real. When we're absorbed in relative reality, it seems really real, but it's just a projection of the play of the four elements. Going further, what happens to our experience of even the light if there's no place for it to land? No screen. Not even particles of dust in the air. The light is unmanifest if there's no object on which it can land. Interesting way to th interesting thought. Joseph is getting quite philosophical here in a way. But it's like he's pointing to the idea that we think things are solid, but it's just stuff. Things happening. My teacher, Guy Armstrong, used to use an interesting analogy, sort of somewhat like this, but quite different in some ways too. That I think I'd like to point out here. Just his this was a thing he would say, and it had the same intent. It's just an interesting image. Imagine that you're not on Earth, but you're in outer space, just in somewhere in the local galaxy, or even like the local, sun and planets world that we're part of. And you go way out to the edge of the local system, way past the last planet. And if you turn towards the sun at that point, which will now be quite small, but you can sort of see the beams of light from the sun coming towards you. That would be the experience, right? And lighting you up in a way. And then you turn around, and all you see is black. All those beams of light you thought that were there, where did they go? Then, because now you're looking in the other direction into the absolute void, and those beams of light aren't landing anywhere anymore at all. We don't see them as beams of light anymore. They're just something that we can't, that's disappeared. And all we have is absolute reality. emptiness, the void. And it's just because we take two different views from the same place. We turn towards the sun and we experience light coming and all that stuff. And we turn away and we experience the opposite. Relative reality, absolute reality. It's interesting that we get there. There is, however, and this is pointed out both by Joseph and by Analeo in different places in their analysis of this. This is like the danger flag. This isn't a yellow warning flag, this is a red danger flag waving. This is like the danger of this idea of absolute relative reality and absolute reality is if you start to think, oh, wow, it's absolute reality that's important. Because that's the ultimate truth, right? Then you can very easily fall into this sort of like nihilist way of looking at things. Like, nothing matters. Because it's all just absolute reality. There's nothing going on. There's no solidity. There's no me there. That other person isn't there. So whatever, however I act towards that other person doesn't make any difference because we're all part of the same thing anyway. And you turn into this way of thinking, you know, in current parlance, you fall down the rabbit hole of this absolutist thinking and you get stuck down the rabbit hole, just lost, because nothing has any meaning anymore. Nothing, because everything is just part of this absolute reality. Why should I care about anything or anybody? And so what's needed here, and this is the tricky part of this whole idea of relative reality versus absolute reality, or sometimes you see relative truth and absolute truth, is we have to somehow take in and understand both of those simultaneously. And understand that both of them are true. Both of them are equally true. They're just, you know, am I facing the sun or facing away from the sun? You know, am I in my day-to-day experience or am I in some deep, concentrated mind state where all that falls away? Which happens in deep states of practice, where the sense of the physical body disappears. You actually literally aren't experiencing body in the way we experience body as we describe it, for instance. Or so I've been told. I've had a little tiny glimpse of that once. Interesting. But. And so we have to keep this balance in our lives, in our day-to-day lives functioning in the world. We can't forget that relative reality is there, and we better pay attention. Otherwise, we're going to start, you know, oh well, nothing's real, nothing's solid, so if I walk into that post, who cares, it's not going to make any difference. Well, if you walk into the post, you're going to bump your head and fall down. That's relative reality in action. You know, so you can't pretend that only absolute reality is relevant. It's the balance of the two, and this practice is about trying to find ways where we can balance those two and live in the world and function in the world, and at the same time be aware that all of that we're experiencing that seems so solid and so real is just, in this case, made up of these four elements that are interacting in certain ways to create the illusion of solidity, of permanence. But that's all that's going on. It's an interesting way to think about things that we have to, and this is central. I think this whole idea is central to the Buddhist teachings and how we, especially as we're not arhats, we're like struggling along, trying to figure things out as we go along. We have to keep this balance in our minds all the time. We can't pretend. If we just live in a relative reality and ignore absolute reality completely, then we're just, going along, not really tuned into what's underneath all that seemingly solid stuff. So we can't do that, and we can't live in the world of just pure absolute reality, because then we can become disconnected from the world. We become nihilistic. That doesn't work either. So we're trying to balance these two all the time. And somehow this practice is a way learning to do that, to balance the two. So that's the second of these two more whole body view teachings. Then we come to the third, and this one is kind of interesting in a different way. This is the last of the teachings on mindfulness of body. As though he were to see a corpse thrown into a charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, living, oozing matter. This is, and it goes on, I'll read more. This is in traditional India of this time, especially out in the villages, they didn't bury people. There was just a space outside the village where dead bodies were just left and gradually did decay, which is what this is describing. And this is actually several verses in the sutta, and Anileo has compressed them into one long teaching here. Being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, or various kinds of worms. A skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinew. A fleshless skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinew. A skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinew. Disconnected bones scattered in all directions. Bones bleached white, the color of shells. Bones heaped up more than a year old. Bones rotten and crumbling to dust. He compares the same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. And the idea here is that this is emphasizing two things. Once again, this is Anileo. Following the instructions given in the sutta, the vision or memory of a decomposing body is applied to one's own body, reflecting that in future, one's own body will undergo the same process of decay. This kind of contemplation also has constitutes a means of counteracting conceit, the idea of separation. Consequently, as indicated, some understanding is then to be applied to the living bodies of others. Here too, the precaution mentioned above in regard to contemplation of the anatomical constitution applies, namely that the exercise should not lead to aversion or repression. So it's basically highlighting two aspects. Just as that contemplation of, all the, going from the hair and the skin down into the internal organs and the heart and the liver and all those things, pointed to the language they use in the commentary, which is the repulsive nature of the body. That the external part of the body is beautiful internally, but internally is not so beautiful. And also, it's pointing to very directly to us, our understanding of the inevitability of death, something we don't often want to think about. But it's like, there it is, for sure. If you sat and actually watched over time, bodies decay, and monastics in the Buddhist time, that's exactly what they did. They'll actually go and sit in charnel grounds and be there while they'd go there every day and sit there, watching bodies slowly decay. And it was a reminder that that's what happens to everyone, without exception. This is what's coming for all of us. Our bodies too are just like this, slowly decaying, more and more of it being stripped off as it slowly decays until literally what's left is just a pile of dust where our bones used to be. And this isn't a pleasant thought. But what the Buddha was trying to do here was to point us towards understanding this is what is going to happen. And the reason he does this in this way and in other ways is to sort of make us understand that, right now you have time to practice and you have energy to practice, but this is where you're headed. Won't always be that way. What Joseph calls spiritual urgency. This is what the Buddha is trying to, he's trying to sort of get people, pay attention. This is what's coming. You better practice now while you still can. And it's like, oh, it's not a pleasant idea, but it's what happens. And we have to sort of take that in. What both Anileo and Joseph in their commentaries suggest is that, probably today in our world, we're not going to get to watch human bodies decay. It's not like in our daily experience, this is not something we're going to have an opportunity to do. And instead, what they suggest is that imagine this is what's happening to your body. Which, by the way, it is. Your body is gradually falling apart. It's the nature of all bodies as they age to get less and less well functioning. So it's in very small ways right now. We lose body hair, and we lose sight, and we lose hearing, and we lose taste. And various parts of the body start to not function so well. But sort of really imagine this is your body and it's slowly disintegrating. Pay attention to that because that's the nature of your body. And then when you take that in, how does that make you feel about intensifying your practice and paying more attention to your practice? It's an interesting way to think of things. And also, and this is something I found in Anilayo. And this is a rich, this idea, this recollection of death, also serves as a useful preparation for the time when one actually has to face death. So this contemplation of death is looking at death in this very clear-headed way, knowing this is where I'm headed, this is what's going to happen. It happens to everyone without exception. As the concluding exercise among the body contemplations, a regular recollection of death can lead to a realization that death is fearful only to the extent to which one identifies with the body. If we make the body, if we sort of identify that body is me, to identify with it in that way, then we're afraid of death. Because we cling to this body in a sense. And with the aid of body contemplations, one can come to realize the true nature of the body and thereby overcome one's attachment to it. Being free from attachment to the body, one will be freed from any fear of physical death. This is also an interesting thought because, you know, if we're afraid when we die, we're not going to be very clear. Our mind is not going to be clear at all. It's going to be like caught by the fear, which is a very powerful emotion. Can we instead, by contemplating death in this way and in other ways, sort of go at the time of death? Strictly imagination. I haven't died yet, so I don't remember. Can we be very clear-headed and be able to sort of keep mindfulness flowing right to the end? Is that a possibility? Is it something we would even want to be able to do? It seems to me I want to be able to do that. It's something that I want to be aware of when that shift happens, because it is a shift. Something goes from one state to another. So that's this whole world of mindfulness of body. As I said, starting simply with mindfulness of breath and mindfulness of body positioning and various forms of motion in the body, to looking at the body as a whole in these ways that point clearly to how our ideas of the body's solidity are illusions. We're just deluding ourselves to think that. And the inevitability of the body decaying and falling apart and not. Because that's what happens to everybody. That's what happens. And can we take that in and be comfortable with that? Don't have to be happy about it. I'm not saying we should be happy about it. So what? But can we be okay? Can we learn to look at it and go, yeah, that's what's happening to not only this body, but all those other bodies out there that I care so much about. That's what happens. It's the nature of having a body. I have a poem that is sort of, I suppose, tangentially connected to what I've been talking about. This is from Wisława Szymborska. She won a Nobel Prize in Literature. She's from some Central European country that I forget. I could probably go look in the bio. I think she was someplace in like Slovakia or someplace like that. But this is an interesting poem pointing to absolute reality. I think this is what this poem is actually about. It's called View with a Grain of Sand. We call it a grain of sand, but it calls itself neither grain nor sand. It does just fine without a name, whether general, particular, permanent, passing, incorrect, or apt. Our glance, our touch, means nothing to it. It doesn't feel itself seen and touched. And that it fell on the windowsill is only our experience, not its. For it is no different from falling on anything else, with no assurance that it has finished falling or that it is falling still. The window has a wonderful view of the lake, but the view doesn't view itself. It exists in this world, colorless, shapeless, soundless, odorless, painless. The lake's floor exists floorlessly And it sure exists shorelessly. Its water feels neither wet nor dry, and its waves to themselves are neither singular nor plural. They splash deaf to their own noise on pebbles neither large nor small. All this beneath the sky, by nature skyless, which the sun sets without setting at all, and hides from hiding behind an unminding cloud. The wind ruffles it, its only reason being that it blows. A second passes, a second, a third, but there are 3 seconds only for us. Time has passed like a courier with urgent news. That's just a simile. The character's invented. His haste is make-believe. It's news inhuman. I've never found a poem that describes this idea of not self in quite so clear a way, that it's all our imagining, our concepts laid on top of things that creates the world, not the actuality of what's really there. It's just we have all these concepts that we keep placing on things that are just our concepts.